last week we were discussing the journey of Abraham, and we said that when you take a look at the Torah, at first sight it seems quite simple. God tells him to leave the his land, and he will make him into a famous person. Everything sounds beautiful. But then when we look close at the text, we find out that there's a problem. And the problem is in the very verse itself, in 12:1, where God says, go leave the land, your land, the land of your father, and go to the land which I will show you. But God does not show him anything at that point. So the question is, how could Abraham possibly fulfill this commandment, and what did he do? Okay, now Abraham, later, in a later verse, discusses the history of his odyssey, and that is in Genesis 20:13, when he's speaking to Avimelech. Okay, so let's take a look at that verse there, 20:13. Now, I don't know what your translation is, but this verse over here is a little tricky. You must know a little bit of Hebrew in order to get the correct interpretation here. Now, the verse states as follows, that when Abraham was trying to appease Avimelech, trying to explain himself, because Avimelech apologized and complained to Abraham, how could you put me in such a situation? So Abraham was being very kind to him, and Abraham sort of apologize. And he goes over the history of his journey. And he says, and it was when God, well, this translation, I'm using the Jerusalem Bible. Actually, the Jerusalem Bible has the correct translation. And it was when God caused me to wander from my father's house. So, of course, the word in Hebrew is hisu, that's the word, and it comes from the word to'eh. To'eh means to wander aimlessly. We have that same word again in Genesis, where Joseph, when he was searching for his brothers, and he was in a conflict, and what happened was that he really didn't want to find them because he was afraid of them, but on the other hand, he had to listen to his father's command. So it says, and a man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. Same word, to'eh. To'eh means, it means wandering aimlessly. That's actually what the meaning of the word is. That verse, if you want to know where it is, the verse is in Genesis 37:15. And a man found him, a certain man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. It means to wander aimlessly. So we see over here, when we look closely, when we scrutinize the Torah, again, the Torah demands scrutiny, when we scrutinize the Torah, we find it's not as simple as we think at first sight. And over here, Abraham is recounting his journey, and what he's stating is that when God caused me to wander aimlessly from the house of my father. So now we understand the question that we raised before. When God told Abraham, leave your land, leave your homeland, so he really didn't know what to do. God says, go to the land. Which land? I'll show you the land. Well, what is Abraham supposed to do right then? And Abraham realized that he has to leave, and God simply expects him to wander aimlessly until he will show him where to go. Now, it just so happens that Abraham intuitively went south towards Israel. Okay, because he was at that time, he was in Haran. I don't know how you pronounce it in English, H-A-R-A-N. Okay, that Haran is really 10 miles north of the Syrian border. It's in Turkey. So he had to travel from there south to Israel, a distance of 400 miles. Now, he wandered aimlessly, but he happened to wander in the right direction. Intuitively, he went south. Did he have a sense intuitively? How did he happen to do that? We don't know. I'm not going to be mystical about it. I guess a mystic would say that he had some sense of the holiness of the land was drawing him there. could be. I mean, I'm not going to venture into that area. But somehow or other, he wandered in the right direction. Now, let me let's scrutinize a little further this verse, okay? God says to Abraham, leave the house, your land, your birthplace, and the house of your father to the land which I will show you. Now, let's take a look at the preceding verse, which is the end of the chapter of Noah. Now, take a look in two verses earlier. That's Genesis 11, verse 31. And what does it say? It says, and Terach took Abraham his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, which was Terach's grandson, and he took Sarai, who was the wife of Abraham, his son, and it says, and he went out with him from Ur Kasdim, that's Ur of the Chaldees, to go to the land of Canaan, and he went to Haran, and he stayed there. Okay, so it's interesting. Apparently, Terach himself had plans of going, of leaving Ur, and going to Canaan. And somehow or other, he had plans to do that. But what happened was, what the reason was, we have no idea. Why should Terach, who was a successful man in Ur, why should he want to leave his homeland of Ur and travel to Canaan? But apparently he didn't travel directly west, because Ur, you see, the city of Ur is in Iraq today. It's a little bit north of Kuwait. It's in Iraq, and if you would go due west, he would really hit Israel. But instead, they traveled north to Haran. That's a distance of about 600 miles. As I said before, Haran is north of Syria in Turkey. So we don't understand what the reason Terach had for leaving his city of Ur. He was respected there. We do know the Midrash says that Terach was actually a very strange man, because he informed on his own son, Abraham, and to Nimrod. And Nimrod tried to kill Abraham, and Abraham escaped through a miracle. That's the Midrash. The Midrash says he was thrown into the, as you probably know, into the fiery furnace, and he emerged unscathed. Maimonides does not mention anything. Question whether the Midrash is to be taken literally or not. Maimonides simply states that he escaped miraculously. It doesn't say what the miracle was. Ibn Ezra is not too happy with the literal interpretation of the Midrash. But at any rate, all agree that somehow or other he was almost put to death. His life was in jeopardy, and he did escape. Now, as you know, as you would expect, I mean, especially you people can appreciate this, the most dangerous thing that a person can do is to go against the religion of the land. In this country, fortunately, this land has no religion. It has many, many different religions. But you can imagine, you can see from within your own framework what happens. And this is different now than it was 20 years ago, as I was discussing with David last week. And you can imagine what it was in those days to go against the religion of the land and to simply state that everything is false and nonsensical. I always considered Socrates to be a very courageous man at his trial and after the trial, and he always stood out in my mind as one of the most courageous men. But when I really thought about it, I had to come to the conclusion that Abraham was much more courageous than Socrates, because Socrates didn't touch the religion. He was afraid. When they accused him of not respecting the gods, of saying that the moon is made out of rock, Socrates backed down, and he stated he doesn't teach such things. But Abraham didn't. Abraham was not afraid to speak the truth, in spite of the fact that his life was in jeopardy. And Abraham's concept was that if your idea of God is distorted, then your entire life has to be distorted, because God is the source of everything. So if that source is wrong, your whole life is going to revolve around a false notion, and it will be absolutely worthless. So when Abraham discovered God, he didn't keep it to himself. He shared it with everyone, to the point where his own father, who was, according to the Medrash, actually, his father was a manufacturer of idols, and his father was so upset that his father turned and informed him. There's an interesting thing. The Rashi states that Terach, and the end of his, Terach, at some point in his life, repented. And how does Rashi know? Because God says to Abraham, you will go to your fathers in peace. So Rashi says, Rashi comments, his father is an idolater, and God is telling him he's going to go to his father. It's not a proper expression. We know the expression to go to your father means to die, but Rashi and the Talmud are very sensitive about the expressions. You don't say that his whole life was against his father. So how could God say to him that this is a wonderful thing? You're going to be buried at an old age, God says to him, and you'll go to your father. But your father is an idolater. It's not appropriate. So Rashi says from here we see that Terach repented. And apparently Terach at some point in his life recognized the God of his son, Abraham, and Rabbi Soloveitchik wanted to say that this is indicated in the Bible, the biblical text itself, where it says that Terach took his son and left Ur, which was his original town, where he was successful and famous, and he had access to the king. So he apparently started to realize that his son was right, and he recognized the God of his son Abraham, and he was upset at the fact. He was really depressed about the fact that he spent his life in Ur, which was actually a very highly civilized kind of city at the time. Ur was very civilized. The archaeological digs in Ur showed a civilization where they even had quadratic equations. They were advanced in mathematics, and it was a metropolis. And apparently, because of his recognition of the God of his son, and the fact that his son had to escape with his life, he left, and he took Abraham, and he was going to go west to Canaan. But he traveled north first, northwest, and he went to Haran, which really was a pastoral town, wasn't a metropolis, and it's difficult for a person ordinarily to leave a big metropolis, especially when he's successful, and to go to a pastoral society where, you mean, it's really quite a letdown. I mean, people usually go the opposite way. But he was apparently content to do this because, as the Medrash says, that he repented. And this, Rabbi Soloveitchik points out that this text actually indicates that he did have a change of heart, and he took his son Abraham, and he left Ur, everything he had there, and he, for some reason, we don't know why, he decided to go to Canaan, but apparently he traveled northwest, and he came to Haran, and he stayed there. More details of his journey we don't know. But now let us take a look at what the Torah teaches us in the two verses later again, where God says to Abraham, God says, leave your land and your birthplace and the house of your father. Now, the question is, how could God say that when he had already left Ur a long time ago? Of course, his father Terach took him out of Ur, took his son and his other son, Haran, and Abraham's wife, and they were already away from Ur. So they're actually 600 miles away from Ur. So what does God mean when he tells Abraham to leave your land? He already was away from his land. I mean, 600 miles is quite a distance even today, and in those days it was a monstrous distance. So Rashi again comments, and Rashi says, how could God say, leave your land? He says, didn't he already leave there with his father, and he went to Haran? So Rashi says, this is what God said to him. God said to him, move further away from there and go from and leave the house of your father. Okay, so according to Rashi, the text means God didn't say leave the God meant God should have God meant and leave the house of your father, and by doing that you'll be distancing yourself even further from your land and from your birthplace. So actually, according to Rashi, the text is not really accurate. The text should have stated leave your father's house first, and then you will be distancing yourself further from your birthplace and from your land, from your land and from your birthplace. The order in the Torah seems to be opposite of what it should be according to Rashi's interpretation. And I mean, Rashi's interpretation is well taken because Rashi's just basing himself on the text which we have before us. So that is a question that we encounter at this point. But let's go a little bit further and let's try to analyze a little further, and we'll see that perhaps through further analysis we'll understand what exactly the commandment that God gave to Abraham. And I think if we're successful, we will find something that's quite remarkable. Let's take a look at another aspect. Let's analyze this verse from another aspect, okay? Forget about what we did so far, and just look at it fresh. Now, it says, God said to Abraham, leave your land, your birthplace, and the house of your father. Now, the question is, why do we have to have all these terms? Okay? So, again, Rashi explains that Rashi says as follows. Rashi says that, Rashi says like this. Rashi says, God did not reveal the land to him immediately. Where he says, go to the land where I will show you. So Rashi comments, Rashi says, God did not reveal to him the land immediately. Why? Because God wanted to make him love it. It should be desirable. Something that he loves in his eyes. And Rashi says, and to give him a reward for every single word. In other words, every word he receives a reward for. Leave your land, you got a reward for that. Your birthplace, another reward. The house of your father, another reward. He says, and Rashi comments, Rashi says, we find this style, this method that God used with Abraham, he uses in other places as well. For instance, he says, take a look at Genesis 22. Okay? Take a look at Genesis 22. We see that God commands Abraham to sacrifice his son, where God tests Abraham. Now, in 22:2, God says, take your son, your only one, the one that you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah. And there you will bring him up as a sacrifice on one of the mountains. Again, it says, which mountain doesn't say. It says, which I will tell you. Okay. He knew the direction, but he didn't know which mountain. Now, over here again, God uses the same exact method. God says, God doesn't say take Isaac. He says take your son, your only son, the one you love, Isaac. So Rashi says, if you study these verses, you see that same method being applied in the case of Abraham's taking of Isaac to... in the Akedah, where Abraham takes Isaac for a sacrifice. And he says, and Rashi continues, and he says again over there, God doesn't tell him where. He says, I will show you in the future. He says, you find the same kind of idea with the prophet Jonah. Because God says to Jonah, he says, go to Nineveh, and he says, tell them, give them the speech which I will tell you, which I will speak to you. But God does not say exactly what that speech is at the time. Okay? Now, what exactly does all this mean? What does it mean? What was God's purpose in doing it in this manner? Okay? The explanation is that God... In giving Abraham a command, or in giving Jonah a command, the way God relates to man is God is man's teacher. He teaches the prophet. He raises him to a higher level. He puts him in a different state of mind and causes him to grapple with his emotions and to rise to a truly high level where his mind is and his knowledge of God is his only guide. Okay? Now, over here, what God did was God told Abraham that he should leave his home. Where should he go? Doesn't say. Wander. He should wander around. But you notice God says, leave your land, your birthplace, and the house of your father. And for every one of these things, he received a reward. Why should he receive a reward for every one of these things? The answer is obvious. The answer is that God, when God told Abraham to go on a journey, this wasn't just a physical journey. This was a philosophical journey. It was a journey of perfecting himself. What God was telling Abraham was the following. You see, Abraham was a great discoverer. He discovered God, basically. He discovered God. Now, when Abraham discovered God, the Rambam, Maimonides, he gives a vivid description of what happened. He discovered God, and then he shared the idea with other people, and he would write. In those days, he would write articles, and he would give them to people, disproving the idolatry. Idolatry is false, completely false. Now, there are two steps involved in disproving idolatry. One is to show what rationally what we mean by God, the source of all creation, and that's one. That's very nice. But you know very well that a person can have an idea of God as the source of creation, and he could still be an idolater. He could use physical means. He could have idols. There are many idolaters that believe in God, but they say these are representations. These are representations. This reminds me of God. What Abraham had to show the people was not just the philosophical idea of God, but he also had to show them psychology. He had to teach them psychology as well. He had to show them that the ideas that they have and the sacrifices that they're making, killing their children, and the whole idea of a deity, of a God, and why they need this material figure in front of their eyes is because they're projecting onto reality something that doesn't exist. They're trying to satisfy certain infantile emotions, and these emotions are completely wrong, completely false. So Abraham really, in discovering God, he discovered God. The discovery of God involves two things. It involves the idea of God, an abstract, a philosophical, but it also involves a lot of psychology. It involves showing a person that these things that you believe are true are really just projections from your own imagination. These aren't real things. And Abraham studied the human mind. And Abraham's discovery, really, if you want to just put Abraham's discovery in a capsule, I would say Abraham discovered that phenomena are not just outside of the self. And here he was in a city, really, that was advanced, and mathematically and architecturally, and in those days, Ur was a very advanced city. And this city, they recognized, they weren't stupid people. They recognized phenomena that they're... You have to deal logically with the external world, and there are phenomena that you have to deal with. And they were intelligent people. But what Abraham discovered was that there were other phenomena also, internal phenomena. It's not just the external is phenomena, but the internal in man is also a phenomena, and you have to study it and analyze it. And you must use your mind with regard to your own emotions, just like you must use your mind with regard to the external world. That was really Abraham's discovery. Now, what God told Abraham was the following. God told Abraham, you're the one that made that discovery, that the emotions of a person are subject to analysis, that you can understand them. You must focus your mind on your emotions. And if you see an emotion which doesn't make sense and you trace it back, you see where it comes from, and it's nonsensical, you can't, that's not reality. That you have to grapple with that in a different kind of way, but you can't allow that emotion to cause you to make a decision. If you come to a decision, for instance, that someone is not good, and then you check in your mind, you see, why do you say this person's not good? And you see it's based simply upon an emotion. There's no basis in reality. And it may be difficult. You may dislike this person. You may hate this person. You don't know why you hate that person. Sometimes a person dislikes somebody, doesn't know why he dislikes them. Not because the person is evil. It's simply he's different. Something bothers him about it. It's hard sometimes to trace it even. But the fact is that a person has to be on a level where he must recognize this is just an emotion. This person didn't do anything wrong, so why do I dislike him? It's my own emotion. Maybe I'm envious of him. Maybe there's another reason why I dislike him. And a person has to grapple with those emotions and study them and not allow them to direct his life. That is really what Abraham taught people. That these emotions, you want to sacrifice your children to the God, you think that this is a religious action, that you're doing something for God, this is nonsensical. You're looking for something to do to make you feel good. But there's no basis that God, and you have no proof that God, that this is what God wants. You want to satisfy some kind of guilt. You want to feel that you accomplished something. But there's no basis in reality. You can't follow that emotion and destroy human life. So Abraham was the one that discovered the analysis of the human mind. What God said to Abraham is as follows. Now that you've come this far, you have to make one more step. You have to remove from yourself a certain emotional attitude that you have until now. And that attitude is the feeling of security that an individual has with regard to their own land, with regard to a place that they lived in all their life. A person, and you have to realize that in those days, especially in those days where there weren't that many cities actually, to leave a city and to go and to wander off into the desert, into a desolate country, was like losing your whole sense of security. You know, the Talmud states that when a person travels on the road, that he doesn't have to pray for 3 days. Because in those days, when a person traveled on the road, it was a danger. You were away from civilization. And when a person would come to his destination, it was a major triumph, and the person was emotionally exhausted. So the Talmud states you can't pray to God unless you have the proper frame of mind. So the Talmud says that if a person travels on a journey, he's not obligated to pray for 3 days, because he shouldn't pray, actually, because he doesn't have his wits about him. Until he calms down. It was a major undertaking. For us, it's hard to imagine, because we live in our society, we live in different times, but in those days, you have to put yourself back into what it was like in those days. So what God told Abraham was, you have one emotion that you still didn't work on, and that is your sense of security that comes from your country, from your birthplace, and the house of your father. So what God told Abraham was, you see, that's why it goes in gradations. First it mentions the country. That's a certain emotion. Then it mentions the birthplace. That's even a closer tie. I was born in this city. It's part of my life, part of my youth. The person's always attached very much to his early youth, his memories that give the person a sense of belonging, roots. And of course, the most powerful one is the house of his father. A person's attachment, primary attachment, from infancy on, is an attachment to his father, his mother, his family. That is the closest, most powerful tie. That's what makes a person feel significant. That's where a person is not just another number in his own home. He's respected, he's recognized. It gives him a sense of security. So God told Abraham, that's why he reversed the order. He told him, because God was speaking on an emotional plane. The emotional plane, that's what Rashi says, to give him reward for every step. What God told him was, break away from those emotions. You still have emotions. You may have left Ur, but you still have emotions that attach you to Ur. You're still thinking about Ur. It's still in the back of your mind. And your father's house still has meaning to you. It gives you there's a certain sense of security that you have. You have to remove yourself. You, Abraham, you are not an ordinary person. Your life is on a higher plane than anybody else. You have to remove yourself completely from any sense of security that you have because of these emotions. An ordinary person, God wouldn't give such an instruction to. He couldn't take it. God deals with each person on their level. But Abraham was a man that was rising to the world of mind, to the world of God's wisdom and knowledge, and God didn't want him to be attached to any kind of emotional weakness. He said, there's still one weakness you have to overcome. How are you going to overcome it? So God said, the method is as follows. You leave your house, leave where you are now in Haran,
All All right, I want to ask you a couple of questions on, and this is something that has been discussed before, and I get asked occasionally. So I think it would be appropriate to put on the tape. You cannot find in the text of the Torah where Abraham's father was an idolater.
No, it doesn't mention that.
All right. You find, if you look at the text, if I counted correctly, that Abraham is...
No, it does say in the Bible that he was an idolater. You know where it says it?
Where?
It says in Joshua. Where's that verse? From years ago, your forefathers were idol worshippers years ago, and I took Abraham from, and they serve strange gods. Where is it? I think it's Joshua. Is that going to have the source over there? Get me regular the other goddess. Or this one have it? Yeah, it's a verse in. I believe it's in Joshua. I may be wrong. But here's the quote. Let me give you the quote. Joshua. And Joshua said to all the people, "Thus said the Lord," I don't have where it is, "the God of Israel, of old your fathers dwelt..."
Where is the quote, Rabbi?
What?
Joshua, what?
Let me get the quote. Get the Yagoda. I'll find a quote for you, okay? It's an open verse in the... in Joshua. Hold on one second. You holding that tape there? Okay. Have you got it? 27? There's no 27. No.
There's no 27-2.
Oh, no, it is. It's 24-2. Mistake.
24-2.
20 foot mistake.
And Joshua said unto all the people, "Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, your fathers dwelt on the other side of the river of old in Terah, the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor, and they served other gods."
That's it.
Now there it is. That works.
Yep.
You're amazing. All right. So there it is. There's the quote. I need to write that one. I'm going to have to put a little note on that one. Joshua 24:2. Okay, you made your point.
Okay. So that's why what Rashi is explaining over here is that from the house of your father to the land which I will show you. So in other words, what God was telling Abraham is, I'm not going to tell you right now where that land is. Why? Because if I tell you where that land is, you're just going to attach your emotions to that place, and you're just going to think this is my new home. I want you to wander aimlessly.
Rabbi,
yes.
We have a question. This is Ms. Gail Ledford.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh. Hello?
Just talk.
Okay.
Don't touch it. I'll hold it.
Rabbi?
Yes?
You gave commentary on Genesis where, and you went backwards in two verses. You went from 12:1 back to the end of chapter 11,
right.
You gave commentaries like it was in that chronological order. Is it not possible that it's not in chronological order?
No, because that's not possible, because over here, before it states that Terach took his son, and if you reverse the order, then what you're going to have is, you can have a problem if you reverse the order. There are other interpretations besides Rashi, by the way. There are other interpretations. And there is the problem with the other interpretation is that if you reverse the order, then what happens is that over here, it's the prime mover is Abraham, whereas in the verse in Genesis 11:31, the prime mover is Terach. So that would be a problem, but there are other opinions. I'm expounding Rashi's position. It is you're asking your question is very good. It's an insightful question, because there are other commentaries that try to work it out differently along those lines. But I'm limiting myself to Rashi's interpretation. I think that Rashi's is the most textual, as he usually is, and I think there's if you follow Rashi. You see, it explains everything, and it gives a great insight into the text itself. Okay, but your point is an excellent point. You're thinking. Okay. All right. So let me continue with our interpretation. Now, Rashi, now according to Rashi, the verse now this whole verse becomes converted to a new phenomenon. I mean, originally we looked at the verse, a little story. God tells Abraham, go, you know, leave the house of your father and go. I'm going to make you a great person, famous, etc. But now we take a look at this verse and we see every word here counts. And it's a whole different journey that Abraham went on. It wasn't so much a physical journey. Yes, it was a strange physical journey. He had to wander aimlessly, not knowing, not being able to attach himself to any place. I mean, you know, like a man without a country is a very difficult emotional kind of thing to face. Why? Because a person feels insecure. I mean, we don't realize how much security we have. The fact that we live in a town, in a country, this has an effect on the whole psyche of a person. What God demanded of Abraham was to give all that up, wander aimlessly, didn't know where he was going. This is according to everybody, by the way. Because it says that that's clear according to everybody that he wandered aimlessly. That of course God didn't disclose which land he's going to go to. So according to Rashi, the text fits beautifully, and that's why the order is reversed, because Rashi explains that God, in giving Abraham this commandment, what he did was he raised him to a higher level. He removed all kinds of emotional attachments and security, and didn't even tell him where he's going to go. Now Rashi explains. Rashi says in a similar fashion, God works the same way. Again, when he tells Abraham to take his son Isaac, he doesn't immediately say Isaac. First he says, take your son. That's in 22. He says, take your son. Now, Abraham had two sons. He had Ishmael. So at that point, Abraham is grappling with the emotion, which son will it be? Then he says, your only son. Your only son, well, there's still two. What does only mean? The one that you love. Which one is that? Isaac. So God zeroes in slowly. And for every expression, it was a different emotion that took place in Abraham's mind.
Does that mean that he didn't love Ishmael?
Not like he did Isaac. You see, originally, you have to understand something. When Abraham said to God, God said to Abraham, your reward is very great. So Abraham responded to God. Abraham said, God, what will you, what can you give me? And I have no children. And the master of my household is Eliezer Damascus. So what was Abraham's request? It wasn't a personal request. It was a request because he realized that the system cannot continue without a son. If he didn't have a son, the whole philosophy would die. As great as Eliezer was, and the rabbis tell us Eliezer was one of the greatest men ever. He was really close to Abraham and he close to God and everything. But nevertheless, the system could, as a system and a nation, it would never work. It had to be a son. A son is a different feeling, and the son was, the world recognized the son as, that's the authentic. He took over his father's ideas, his father's world of ideas. He knows the ideas, and this is a psychological phenomenon. So, at first Abraham thought that the son that's going to take over is Ishmael. If you remember, Abraham said to God, when God mentioned to him about a son, he's going to have another son. Abraham said, "I'll be happy if Ishmael will live." He was shocked. He laughed. He was surprised, completely surprised. That's in where is it? It's right. And it's, excuse me, just one second. Yes, that's in 17 verses 17 and 18. See. Abraham fell on his face, and he laughed, and he said, will a 100-year-old man give birth, and with Sarah, a wife of 90? And then Abraham said to God, Lu means like, talk to the translator. It means, I only wish that Ishmael should live before you. So apparently at that point he thought that Ishmael was going to be the one that was going to carry on the tradition and the ideas of Abraham. But God knew otherwise, that Ishmael wasn't capable of doing that. So that's why God gave him Isaac, and God told him, through Isaac you are going to have seed. Now once that became known to Abraham, obviously, where would his emotions of love fall? His emotions of love would naturally fall to that son. See, I want to explain something to you. A great person has emotions too. This is always a problem in Judaism, because Judaism is very intellectual and it's very much a religion of the mind. So then people say, well, where are the emotions? You have to understand, a great person has emotions, but a great person, his emotions are different than an ordinary person. In what manner? I guess the best example I could give you would be the case of Jacob. Jacob loved Joseph. Right? We all know Jacob loved Joseph more than all his other children. But why did he love Joseph? An interesting thing. So the Torah says that this is in Genesis 37:3, and Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons. Why? Because he was, it says in Hebrew, he was to him a ben zekunim. What does it mean, ben zekunim? A son of his old age? That's the literal translation. There's a problem with that translation of son of his old age, because he really wasn't much older when Joseph was born than it was within a year or so. It wasn't really much of a distance. Actually, later, the greater distance was between Joseph and Benjamin. So Benjamin should have been the older son. So Tirgum, Unculus the proselyte, translates, he says, the word Zokain means wise. He says, because what the Torah means is he loved him because he was a wise son. Now, what Unculus does with that translation is he's not just giving you a translation, he's showing you an idea, a concept, and that is that Jacob didn't love Joseph because he was Rachel's son. Correct? He loved him because he was a wise son. But we know as well that Joseph had special meaning to him because he was Rachel's son. So why did he love him? The answer is, essentially, he loved him because he was wise. If Joseph was not a wise son, if Joseph was a stupid son, he couldn't just love him because it's his wife's, his true wife. Abraham, Jacob's true wife was really Rachel. Leah was really someone that imposed on his life. He wasn't happy with Leah. He didn't want Leah. As a matter of fact, the Talmud states that he wanted to divorce her. And if you look at the verses, you can see this between the lines, because every time she had a child, she said, now my husband will love me. Now my husband will become attached to me. So she sensed the hostility from Jacob. Jacob really was fooled with Leah, and he was angry at her because she went along with Laban and fooled him. But he couldn't divorce her immediately because it wouldn't be appropriate. I mean, after all, he was working for father, and he made the deal, and Laban was a very convincing businessman, and he coerced him sort of into it, and he couldn't get out of it right away. But the Talmud says that he really eventually wanted to get rid of her. He just was waiting his time. Meantime, he had these children, and then he said, am I going to divorce the mother of these children? Because he saw they were, he realized that these children are going to be the tribes that are going to establish the whole nation. So he had a change of heart. But the truth of the matter is, he always loved Rachel. That was the one that he really loved. And what happened was that when she had a child, that child, of course, had special meaning to him. But what Unculus is teaching us is that the great Jacob could not just love a child because it's the child of his favorite wife, of his true love. Why? Because it's empty. See, a great person can enjoy a child, but not just the empty emotion of a child. If the child's intelligent, if the child is something special, then he enjoys the emotion as well. But just to enjoy the emotion, just because it happens to be his son, the son of this wife, and he's an ignorant son, and he's not intelligent, and he's not ethical, and there's nothing really great about him, he would never enjoy that son. Then his favorites would be the other brothers, the ones that have true quality. So the emotions of a great person, a person who is great, enjoys his emotions and the ideas of the Torah. But it must always be with ideas, with knowledge. I'll give you an example of friendship. Torah friendship is a different kind of friendship. Friendship in general is based upon common emotions. I mean, you have common feelings, you like the same movies, the same sports, whatever, some kind of commonality. But a Torah man really can't have such kind of a friend. He's a nice guy, he helps you, he's nice. You can have a friend like that on a certain level. But what is a true friend in the Torah world? In the Torah world, a true friend is a friend that you share the greatest gift of all, a friend that you share knowledge. And if you can't share knowledge with your friend, it really has very little meaning. The friendship has very little meaning. I mean, I know this is so in my personal life, and I know that many of you experience that same kind of a thing. So Torah raises the person to a level where his emotions, he enjoys the emotions of friendship, of course. But the friendship can't just be an empty friendship. It has to have ideas. It has to be with something, a higher element in it. If the higher element is lacking, then the emotions can't exist. Whereas with the ordinary person, all they have is the hollow emotion, you know, the shallow emotion, and they just live with the emotion itself. So over here as well with Abraham, his favorite son was Isaac because of the fact that he saw that besides the fact that God told him, he saw the difference between Isaac and Ishmael. He saw Ishmael is not the one, he doesn't have the quality, he doesn't have those qualities. But Isaac does have those qualities, and that's why he was attached to him and drawn to him, and he loved him, and it was his favorite son. So, but God didn't disclose immediately, he didn't tell him immediately take Isaac. He told him first, grapple with the emotion of your sons. Which ones? Just think about it. Then once he conceded to that, each step of the way was another dimension of overcoming his emotions towards his children and finally towards Isaac. So God is a teacher. God teaches man in a way that he doesn't just suddenly say, take your son Isaac. He gradually introduced him, so he learns. He overcame one emotion. Now the next step, and now the next step. And God didn't say where exactly the spot is that he's going to bring Isaac as a sacrifice. Why? Because as long as the spot was not finalized, in his mind he was still grappling with the emotion. You see, there's a certain when you have a finality, your mind is finished with it. If God would have told him the place, that would have been a certain kind of finality. He didn't tell him the place. He kept him in suspense. The suspense caused him to constantly be involved in the conflict and the difficulty. And that's what God wanted him to do, to work over those emotions. That's what Rashi means over there, that God didn't tell him where. And the same thing, God used the same method with the prophet Jonah. Why? Because Jonah was reluctant to go to Nineveh. Why was he reluctant to go to Nineveh? Because he did not believe that these people deserve forgiveness. He believed Nineveh were wicked people. They deserve to be destroyed. And it bothered him. He felt that God should not give them a second chance. They don't deserve a chance. They've reached a level where they're not human beings anymore. They deserve to be destroyed. But God saw differently. God said, no. He says, you go. And he says, but the speech I will give you later when you get there. Why? Because since Jonah was reluctant to go, and he didn't know what that speech was, he was kept in a state of suspense. What kind of a speech could it be? Will it be effective? Will it not be effective? He was hoping it wouldn't be effective. But God kept him in a state of suspense, so he had to grapple with his own emotion and his own desire not to go. So God is, when God reveals himself to man, he reveals himself to man as a teacher, primarily as a teacher. So the same thing is true with this verse that we took up with the with Abraham. Go from your land, from your birthplace, and from your father's house. You have to remove yourself from those emotions. The most difficult one, the last one, is the most difficult one, because that's the most potent. So where are you going to go? I'm not going to give you the security. You don't know where you're going to go. I'll show it to you in the future. Meantime, he wandered. He wandered toa. The word says it said he wandered aimlessly. Ramban says, he wandered like a lost sheep through the desert. He didn't know where he was going, no destination. But in that wandering, he was able to overcome those emotions. Then, when God told him where the land is, the land of Canaan, so after he overcame those emotions, there was only one source of security that he had from that land. And that was actually the fact that this land is the land that God instructed him to live in for no other reason than in the future generations, this land will be important to a nation that's going to live hundreds of years after his time. And the truth of the matter is that he moved to Canaan. It was a terrible place because in Haran, he had his family there. He had Laban and the family. You see, he lived among the Canaanites, which he despised. As a matter of fact, you know very well, when his son Isaac needed to marry someone, so what did Abraham tell Eliezer? He said to him, he said, don't allow my son to marry one of these Canaanites, from the Canaanite people, because they were very primitive. He says, but go to my family. And he sent them back to Haran.
Rabbi?
Yep.
Question. We have talked about faith before, what is faith, what is not faith. But would you not say that right here that Abraham exercised faith when he said that when God told him to go to a land that I will show you, and then Abraham left? Would that not be a pure example of faith?
You see, I wouldn't say that action itself is faith, because Abraham, you see, the way the rabbis explain, when a prophet receives a prophecy, he has no doubt about it. When a prophet receives a prophecy, it's like you're looking at that wall. He knows he's received the prophecy. No prophet ever doubts it. The experience of prophecy is one that the person who experiences it is certain about it, just as certain as he is of his senses. So he knew that God told him to do that. Now, once a person knows that God tells him to do that, he's instructed by God to do that, there's no doubt that he will do it. So I wouldn't say that that is a matter of faith, because he knows that God told him, I will tell you in the future. He believes God. He doesn't think God is going to tell him a lie. So it's as sure as you cannot have any greater security than that. That's the greatest guarantee. If God says, I will tell you, he knew God will tell him. So that really wasn't such a great thing. The important thing over here was, the greatness over here was, to experience being alone, wandering aimlessly, to leave your family, to leave all those emotions, all those ties. That was his greatness. That was where the greatness of the man emerges. And what happened was, God told him, once you broke all those ties, now there's only one security that you're going to have. The security of living in a land which is tied up with my divine plan. It has no other value. It doesn't have anything else. You're among strangers, people that you really look down upon, idolaters. You don't want your children to even have anything to do with these people. But you're living here for one reason, because this is part of my divine plan, and my divine plan demands that the people that will emerge from you generations later, centuries later, these people will have a special, this land will be special to them, because they will think, my forefather Abraham, the one who discovered God, he lived here. So when I live in Israel, it reminds me of the ideas of an Abraham. And because of that, that's why I want you to live here. So the only security, Abraham forfeited all the emotional security that a normal person has with regard to where he lives, his family, his friends. And he lived alone, all alone, wandered alone. But the only security that he had was the security that he's living in the place that God instructed him to live, and that's a part of the divine plan. That is the real security. That's a security not of the emotions, that's a security of the mind. Where the person's knowledge tells them that the emotion of security had to be removed. You see, there's a process of removing it from the emotional life and reattaching it to the world of knowledge of God. So this verse, which, as I said, when you look at it on the first sight, it looks like a very simple verse, but when you analyze it carefully, a whole new picture emerges. Yes.
We got another little question along this line.
Go right ahead.
Rabbi. You just explained this security that he had.
Yes.
I'm having problem understanding how he can have this security and still wander aimlessly.
Oh, okay, let me clarify that point. I'm sorry, that's my fault. There were two parts to the process. First, there was the wandering aimlessly where he suffered, and he had to remove all the emotions of the ties. That was the first process. Once he removed those emotions and he got rid of that, now God told him where the land is, and then he attached himself to that land, and the attachment was a pure one. It wasn't an attachment where he were of substitution. He didn't substitute the emotions of the previous attachment to this land, because he rid himself of the emotions by being alone and wandering. Once he rid himself of those attachments and he thought them through and he understood them, then he was ready to have an attachment, a pure attachment, to the land of Israel, which is the land that God instructed him, that's a part of the divine plan. That's when he was able to do it. But he would never be able to do that if he couldn't study, analyze, understand, and remove those powerful emotions. He would never be able to attach himself to the true idea of security. In order to reach the true idea of security, you have to break through the false idea of security. If you don't break through the false idea, you're never going to be able to reach the true idea. So that wandering was a perfection, a process of perfection that Abraham underwent. Then he was able to attach himself to the true idea. Okay? Is that clear?
Your statement is clear, but I don't know if it's playing in Athens or not. The point is, and we only have about 2 minutes, so we might want to pick this up next go-round, is the fact that there has to be some type of faith, belief in God, in order either what he's seen God do in the past or what he's done for others, that he has this faith in God that he's going to accomplish what he said.
Well, it would be impossible. I mean, you know, from that standpoint, it would be impossible. I mean, if the President of the United States told you, well, I don't know, it depends on the president, but I'm just saying, if you had someone who was trustworthy and they guaranteed you a job, if you do, they guaranteed you certain, they gave you certain security, guaranteed you a certain sum of money, and the person was an honorable person, you certainly would feel secure about that. Now, with God, God's guarantee is the greatest guarantee. If a person doesn't feel secure, if God says he's going to do something, and the person is doubtful about that, that's not a matter of faith, that's an idiot. I mean, it's a person that just doesn't have any idea of God. Once a person knows God, knows what God, and knows, has an idea of God, and God communicates to them, and God tells them that such and such is going to take place, is going to be done, there's no reason for faith anymore. There can't be anything more real. I mean, what could you put your faith in more than the source of all creation? You don't need faith. This is knowledge.
Don, you're slow on the button. We've got 20 seconds left. Yeah, 20 seconds.
Okay.
So we'll just stop right there.
Okay.
And pick it up the next time. And I apologize for that squeal. I was waiting for Don to turn it down, and he was waiting on me to push or something.
Okay, it's Don's fault.
Yeah, it's Don's fault.